Welcome to Grumpy Strategist episode 63. I'm still your host, SAA's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm joined in the SAA bunker precinct here in the Brindabellas by the head of research and bioengineering, Dr. Marcus Hellier. Marcus.
Hello, Michael. Yes, head of research. I'm doing scientific research today. You, as a historian, Michael, you will remember the Fischer-Tropsch method.
Exactly. Those Nazis used it to synthesize oil during the Second World War when they couldn't get
Correct. Oil. They actually did turn coal into liquid fuel. We're going to have to do that. Diesel is drying up in these parts.
The Hellier Fischer-Kopf process.
But I'm looking around. What do we have a lot of that we can synthesize into liquid fuel? And I guess it's pretty obvious. We have defense reviews. We have defense reviews by the truckload. So I'm working on it. I'm very close. I'm going to patent it. And we are going to turn defense reviews and paperwork into liquid fuel. We'll keep the bunker going forever.
One of the hardest things with biofuels is getting reliable feedstock. And Russell offices and the offices of Pat Comroy and Dickie Miles, and then the separate production of Richard Miles' office, has an unending supply of biomass feedstock in the form of defence paperwork and announcements. So I think you've got a reliable supply.
I think we can honestly say that is the only thing they can reliably supply.
I was using those publications for sound deadening here in the bunker, but I see. But yeah, look, that's great, because those diesel tanks are not going to last forever.
They are not.
And whatever happens, if that war in Iran that we're now a part of ends today, the ripple effects of the shutdown of the oil refineries, the gas refineries, fertilizer production, naphtha production, that is going to affect the global economy for months, even if the war ends tonight.
You're such a pessimist. You don't believe Donald Trump is playing five-dimensional chess? You don't think he's got this all worked out?
I think there's a comedian that keeps saying, Trump says, you know, when people say he's playing five-dimensional chess, he says, no, you know, the Iranians are playing checkers. I'm playing Go Fish.
All right. So here we are.
Take a break from the feedstock, because I think we've got to take stock in another way.
Well, we're over a week into the latest iteration of the Gulf War. A lot has happened. And the further we go into it, this, the more people get involved. So first of all, we were sort of sitting on the sidelines. We, Australia, were quite happy to support.
Yes.
But we weren't actually going to do anything. Well, as the ripples spread, looks like we're getting drawn into this.
Wait a minute. Not all of the parliament was happy to support. The coalition wanted to congratulate America and Israel on this war.
Now, I don't want to get too rude about this, but when I hear politicians congratulating Trump on starting a war, I just go, what effing planet are you from? You can support the war, you may think it's a good idea, but to congratulate somebody for starting a war that will lead to the deaths of thousands of people,
has already,
and have this ripple effect around the world, wars are not good things.
No.
Hello, coalition. Hello, people in Parliament House. Wars are bad things.
Yes.
Okay. You do everything you can to avoid them. You do not congratulate people for starting them, particularly when the person who started this one has no idea where it's going. He has no plan and no strategy.
No. Well, we'll talk a bit about that. But I
think rant over.
The other thing to remember is, at the heart of our parliament itself, New Parliament House was designed specifically to have a set of doors. You open the front doors and you open doors all the way through the building, through the great hall, through the courtyards, right into the cabinet room. And the purpose of that design was so if the Australian government was taking a decision to send Australians to war, they would open all the doors and they could look at the war memorial directly across the lake from the cabinet room because of the gravity and solemnity of that decision.
Yeah.
So there's no congratulations about starting a war or getting involved
in it. That attempt by the coalition to pass a motion congratulating Trump, A, first of all, shows they are not serious people, and B, they are trying to politicise what is a really bad situation. Now, on the issue of wars being horrible, there's been a lot of talk recently about the sinking sinking of the IRIS Dana, the Uranian frigate. That was sunk by a United States Navy submarine in international waters in the vicinity of Sri Lanka. Mm-hmm. And people have said, well, this is illegal, it's terrible. And other people have said, no, it's completely legal.
Mm.
I'll give you my view of it. Firstly, I think the overall war is illegal. However, now that war has started...
Now there's a state of war.
There is a state of war. Theoretically, in principle, all of the actions in that are illegal. But from the perspective of an individual actor, you can do something in that war that complies with the laws of war and is legal.
So, you can conduct combat lawfully.
Correct.
Once there's a state of war.
Correct.
Yep.
So, I mean, you look at World War II, you know, the international community after World War II, Nuremberg trials said, you know, that Germany's actions in invading its neighbours during the war were, or to start the war, was illegal. That didn't mean that every action by a German soldier during World War II was illegal.
No.
Certain actions were. So rounding up Jews on the Eastern Front and murdering them
Murdering was clearly Polish officers in a forest after they'd been captured. Murdering POWs, illegal.
Yep. Yes, but so, actually conducting combat operations was not in and of itself illegal, essentially an illegal act by those participants.
Back to the US submarines.
So back to the US submarines, in my view, and again, I don't know all of the details, for a US submarine captain to sink that Iranian frigate is not illegal. I mean, I think it would be kind of weird if the US Navy didn't, considering they are destroying the Iranian Navy in the Gulf through airstrikes.
Well, I think the day that story broke about that frigate sinking, the Americans were announcing they'd destroyed 20 other Iranian warships closer to Iran.
Yeah, and the Iranians have said they're going to block the Straits of Hormuz. They're going to stop oil getting out of the Gulf. Okay, that's part of their way of responding to Trump's strikes. So I think it would be truly bizarre for the US to leave an Iranian frigate sitting on the world's busiest sea lanes, because where do the ships go once they leave the Straits of
Sri Lanka?
They go around the bottom of Sri Lanka. Yep. So to leave an Iranian frigate there armed with anti-ship missiles
is illogical.
Would be truly bizarre. So yes, I think it's justified for the US to sink that frigate.
However, can I just bring you to the point of, okay, sinking it's fine. Once you've sunk it, you've got Iranian soldiers dead and you've got others in the water, wounded and not wounded. What happens then?
Well, and again, I don't know. I don't know who got on the phone to who to say, come and rescue these people. I do think it is not sort of within the kind of SOP, standard operating procedures, of submarines to sink ships, then surface and rescue everybody. I mean, if you're a US Navy submarine commander, you want to sink the ship and disappear as stealthily as possible. Now, that's not normally would be within the context of a war with a great power such as China or Russia, where there's other Chinese or Russian assets that could sink you.
Yes, wouldn't the American submarine commander have had reliable surveillance and intelligence about it being very unlikely that there was an Iranian threat nearby?
Correct, but I don't know. So I don't know who called who. I don't know what the US ship did or didn't do. The point, I think, Michael, is to get back to what we were saying before. Wars are horrible.
Yep.
So there's now 100 Iranian sailors who, many of whom would have been very young people who are just sailors.
Doing their job.
Who are probably sitting on that ship going, holy crap, we're heading out to sea, and between us and home, well, home is not safe because 20 Iranian ships have been sunk, and we actually have to transit the Indian Ocean, which is full of half the US Navy.
And we know that because they were in this multilateral exercise in India that we are coming home from.
Well, plus Trump has been saying for months, I'm sending most of the US Navy to the Gulf.
Yeah.
So they're probably sitting there absolutely terrified, and you sort of got to wonder, what was the Iranian captain thinking?
Yeah.
I mean, why didn't he just simply intern his vessel in India? I mean, unless there was a commissar, an IRGC official pointing a revolver at his head.
Sort of minders like the Iranian women's soccer team.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. So to sort of wrap this up, the act of sinking the Dana, I think, was probably legal within the broader context of...
Lawful within the context of the war.
Yep. Yes.
Yep.
But it just... I think, reinforces the fact that wars are horrible. Ooh. And to congratulate yeah. people for starting wars, I think, is just completely misguided yes. and deluded.
I think all of our elected members and senators should go to the Parliament House forecourt and look across to the war memorial as they think about this war, because the designer understood the gravity of war, and so should all of our elected representatives. Absolutely.
So yes. So we, the government didn't congratulate, but they did say they support.
Yep.
They didn't say they support the war in general. They said they supported the effort to sort
strikes
of
on the nuclear
destroy.
Program. Yeah. Yeah.
Iran's nuclear capability. Yeah. Of course, it's very hard to just seek one end in a war that, because wars
well,
tend
I,
to spread very rapidly. We're seeing the war spread rapidly as more and more countries are drawn in, including Australia. So we wanted to just support, but sort of watch. But today's announcement,
yes,
we are sending forces to
yes.
the Gulf, but they are purely defensive. Michael, do you think there is such a thing as a purely defensive contribution?
Well, first of all, I'd just say the last Gulf War was done by a coalition of the willing,
yes,
who were involved in the planning and the international discussion of legitimacy beforehand. This war is now being fought by a coalescence of the partly willing.
Yes.
So a coalition of the willing has now become a coalescence of the partly willing.
Yeah, so we have people like Starmer, who's not quite sure if he's in or out, not quite sure if what he's sending or not sending. So
yeah.
like much yeah. of the Starmer reign, it's been pretty confused and kind of pointless.
Well, it's a sort of random walk through whatever's already happening. Except he's always on the back foot.
Yes. Mr. Macron, President of France, has said he is going to send naval assets to escort tankers through the Straits of Hormuz. I'm not sure if he's doing that because he wants the oil or if he just sort of wants to rub in the fact that he has a navy now
and the UK basically doesn't. That's very interesting, isn't it? Because so Macron disagreed with Trump about the war at the start, and he supported Spain's Prime Minister Sanchez, who said the war was illegal. And Trump said, well, I'm going to punish Spain economically because of that. Macron publicly endorsed Sanchez and said EU solidarity would be maintained against Trump's threats. But now Macron, demonstrating that France is a substantial military power, has announced he's sending 8 frigates and their big Charles de Gaulle aircraft carrier to the Gulf to do tanker and shipping protection and escort. And meanwhile, the UK, the other AUKUS partner, they announced a while ago they were sending a destroyer to help protect Cyprus, but HMS Dragon still hasn't left Portsmouth yet. There's been some maintenance issues. And it looks like they're not going to send their aircraft carrier. They had one, the Prince of Wales, that apparently was almost ready, but apparently they're thinking about not sending that now.
Well, yes. So it's a reminder that 2 is not a capability. So 1 is definitely not a capability. 2 is also not really a capability. So the UK has 2 carriers. The QE2 is in long-term maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
Can't get ready in
God
time.
God bless her.
Prince of Wales in short-term maintenance. They might be able to get it ready, but Ooh. It's always tricky. And the even 6 is not necessarily a capability, because the UK has 6 nuclear-powered attack submarines. That one was out here on a visit.
It's left at short notice.
It's yeah. disappeared. One would suspect it's on its way to the Gulf.
Well, we've declared victory on the AUKUS maintenance tasks early. So that's good news. But what Starmer is doing that's much more important than what he is able to actually send with his own military because of their state of disarray is he's given access to American bombers to use the Guildford base, RAF Guildford, in the UK. And he's got American B-1s and B-52 Stratofortresses there now.
Which he originally said he wasn't going to do.
And then he said they're only able to use it for defensive purposes. But I don't know about what you think about a B-52 and a B-1
as a defensive B-52.
Weapon, because the B-52 is going to be dropping precision-guided but otherwise dumb bombs on Iran. And that, to me, is hard to characterize as a defensive action.
Well, if you're taking out ballistic missile launching facilities, then you could describe it as defensive. And this is the problem with Albo's characterization of the Australian contribution.
Yes.
So this morning it was announced that Australia was going to send a wedge-tail airborne early warning and control aircraft, so which had served with distinction already in various iterations of Gulf conflicts.
Yep.
A very capable system, along with some AMRAAM missiles, so some short-range air-to-air missiles or medium-range air-to-air missiles.
Yes, they can be loaded into the air defense systems as well.
They can be used air-to-air, and if you've got the right system, you can use them in a ground-based system. But, okay, let's take Wedgetail. Is it a defensive system? Well, theoretically, you go, well, if it's flying loops above the Gulf, it can see Iran's air force sending launching raids. But according to Trump, they haven't got an air force left. So not doing much there. But it could be detecting incoming missiles, say ballistic missile launches.
And providing tracking information to interceptors and fighter aircraft.
Correct. Sounds very defensive.
Yep.
What happens, however, if the US goes, okay, the Wedgetail's just told us that five missiles have been launched from this kilometre area.
Patch of ground in Iran.
Yeah, so we're going to fire some missiles back. Or we're going to launch some airstrikes there. Well, is that now defensive?
Yeah, has the Wedgetail enabled offensive operations? Well, this is my thought about, you know, this coalescence of partly willing partners. A lot of these partly willing partners are saying, hey, look, you Americans and Israelis, you're doing the offensive war on Iran. We're just purely in defensive purposes for our own nationals and Gulf state partners, and maybe your bases too, but we're taking no part in this offensive war. There's no separate room in the war between defensive stuff and offensive stuff. If you're in the war, you're in the war. And this idea that the Wedgetail crews, if they do identify targeting information that will help the US and Israelis attack Iranian military capabilities, the Americans and Israelis are going to use that. And it'll be like, you know, the three Australian crew on the US nuclear submarine that sank the Iranian frigate. Apparently, even though they're part of the crew, they took no part in the offensive against Iran. So the standard operating procedure for the Australians who are involved in the war, I think, goes something like this. They're operating the submarine with their American colleagues. The optical mast of the submarine shows the Iranian frigate in the crosshairs. At that point, the US commander says, "You Aussies, get some shut eye." And the Australians shut their eyes. The button gets pushed and the Iranian frigate is sunk, but the Australians have had no involvement in the war. So I just hope when they get some shut eye in the Wedgetail that they stay aware of their altitude and speed. So you're in the war. We are now in the war. And this attempt to artificially quarantine defensive from offensive is a fiction.
Yes. Now, some people have described this as mission creep.
Who's this creep you're talking about?
Sorry?
Who is this creep?
Well, there's many creeps here. There's one big orange creep in Washington, but we're not going to talk about that creep. So mission creep, the term has been used.
Yes.
And I heard one analyst being interviewed yesterday saying, no, this is not mission creep. This is a prudent response, this being Australia sending assets to the Middle East. So Australia sending assets to the Middle East is not mission creep. It's a prudent response to what is occurring.
However, Marcus, what is kind of the working definition of mission creep? Because I think there was a lot of it in the Vietnam War. I think Robert McNamara, the then Secretary of War, who wasn't sounding like a drunken teenager, sort of hooplaring his team as they beat up an opponent, like the current Secretary of War. He was a very measured man. He talked about mission creep a lot in his Fog of War series. So what is it?
Well, first of all, I'd say there's two answers to this. The first is, yes, it is mission creep. The second answer is, no, it's not mission creep, because there was no mission there in the first place. So how can you have mission creep if there's no clearly defined mission to creep beyond?
So mission creep is a bit like, you know, I heard a lady on radio saying, I remember Vietnam. The first thing Australia did as part of its burgeoning and escalating involvement in that war was to send some army advisors to help out the Vietnamese. And at the end of it, we had a massive physical deployment that led to a whole aggrieved, traumatized cohort of veterans, the Vietnam veterans.
Yeah, so Mission Creep is this concept that you enter into a particular operation or campaign with a certain set of goals and you're willing to commit a certain set of resources to that and hopefully limit the risk and cost.
Yep. Job done.
But however, as the situation evolves, you need to commit more resources because the resources you've got there are inadequate or they're threatened.
Something
and you need
new
to
happens.
Respond.
Yeah.
You know, and so, for example, in Vietnam, US ships were attacked, so they had to respond to that to protect their ships and take out the threat. Or in the case of Australia, we had advisors, but that wasn't sufficient, so we then had troops on the ground and the number of troops on the ground grew. So, I mean, there are many, many studies into mission creep.
Yep.
The thing about mission creep, as Mr. McNamara would say, is each one of the decisions to increase the commitment seemed perfectly sensible and prudent
in the moment. Yeah, so you take this escalating series of decisions where you keep expanding your commitment. Each one in isolation makes sense, but at the end of it, you've broadened and escalated the war.
And you are a thoroughly boiled frog.
And this war is broadening and escalating. This war is definitely already a week in broadening and escalating. So the Gulf states are all involved now. The Saudis are involved. The Iraqis are involved. The Americans have attacked Iraqi militia in Iraq because Iraqi militia are supporting Iran and have been attacking the US embassy and other places.
Yeah.
So and we're now in the war.
Yeah. So
mission creep is happening in the
this
war.
This is clearly mission creep. And the fact that it makes sense at the time doesn't mean it's not mission creep. It just confirms the fact that it is because the situation is changing and you're responding and you're getting drawn further and further in.
I mean, I experienced mission creep at the Canberra Casino. You know, I go in, I'm going to only put $500 through the pokies, but just as I'm reaching $480, I'm running out of money, but I know I'm feeling lucky. So I put some more in.
Your numbers are about to come up, yeah.
And my wife says to me, Michael, that's mission creep, darling. Stop.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm feeling pretty lucky. So.
And did you stop?
Not last week, no.
So is that why you don't have as many kids around the place?
It's just temporary. I mean, medical experiments are a great little revenue earner. So mission creep is happening. You're right.
I think Mr. Macron would definitely say mission creep is happening because last week he didn't have any ships in the Gulf.
Well, the other thing, why will mission creep keep happening? So we're hearing out of President Trump and Secretary Hegseth that the war is going swimmingly. They're ahead of schedule. You know, it's like they're a bus driver and they're ahead of schedule. They only thought they'd get to 3 stops. They're actually at 6 stops. They're delighted with the way the bus is travelling.
It's all going swimmingly well.
Well, it's going super well, except while they have heaps of munitions and everything they need, President Trump called all the top executives of about 15 different defence companies into the White House to demand that they increase production of these same weapons as a matter of national emergency. So I don't think those two things fit. We've got everything we need, but it's a national emergency that you companies have to respond to immediately.
Which is a bit odd because I would have thought the weapons companies would have been producing weapons as fast as they could have at the moment because everybody in the world is trying to buy their weapons, including Australia.
Well, actually, they are, and that's what the companies have said. In fact, post the meeting, a couple of the companies at least have said, so yes, we'd already started trying to increase production before the meeting. We're still trying to increase production. So that tells me actually it's not going as swimmingly as we thought. Then the US is also pulling extra diplomatic staff and families out of countries like Turkey and Saudi Arabia. So why are they pulling more Americans out of the region if this thing's almost over and it's going swimmingly well and Iran can't attack anybody? So Turkey and Saudi Arabia, they're pulling staff out of there. They're diverting missile orders other countries have made with US companies.
Hopefully not
to
ours.
The Gulf. I think ours are part of that diversion, those M1s. Like, we're dressing it up like this is a bold Australian decision. I think it's a told Australian decision. We were told this was happening and we've said, what a great idea. Can it please be my decision?
Yeah, so are the AMRAAMs that Australia is providing to, is it to UAE?
Yes, to the UAE. Yeah.
Is it ones we have in stock already or is it our future orders? Because my advice to Alba would be, do not give up the missiles we actually have because you never know when you're going to get replacements.
Well, you know, before this war, it was taking the US Air Force 3 years and 4 months from the time they made an order for these missiles to getting the order. Now, that's their home top priority customer. Every other purchaser, including Australia, it's more like somewhere between 4 and 8 years. That was before the extreme demands of this war. So you're right. If you've got one of those missiles and you give it to someone else or fire it, you're not going to get another one for at least four years or more.
Like everybody else, we do not have deep magazines. Now, the number of missiles we have, of course, is classified. But if you look at the history of Australian orders that have to the US, because they get published
by the Americans,
because once it's approved by the State Department, it has to be made public. So you have a rough idea of how many we have, and we probably have, you know, several hundred, maybe 300, maybe 400 mm-hmm. AMRAAMs.
Yep.
Okay. Well, I don't know how many we're providing, you know, and every bit helps.
Yep.
I get that, but it's not going to be a game changer. So there's been some work done on
usage rates
yep. done very early in the yep. current iteration of the Gulf Wars. 36 hours in. So this is
day and a half. Yep.
A study that we'll put a link on. Day and a half into the war, the US and the Gulf states had expended 700 high-end defensive interceptors. So that includes the SM family of weapons, so SM-2, SM-3, yep. SM-6.
Yep.
It includes the Patriot family mm-hmm. of weapons. It includes THAAD, which is like
the world's really, most expensive weapon.
The really big one.
They're about 12 million US a weapon, I think.
Yeah, yeah. They're insanely expensive. I think SM-6 is about 6 million US, so 10 million Aussie roughly. So those ones, and then some of the smaller ones such as AMRAAM AIM-9X. But 700 high-end ones.
Just in the first 36 hours.
In 36 hours. So we're over
a week in. The use rate will have dropped a bit because Iranian missile and drone attacks have drop back a bit, but not too much.
Not too much, and hopefully they're not using THAAD to shoot down Shahid drones. But
didn't the Gulf states pop off these very expensive interceptors at a massive rate of fire?
Well, according to this study, and again, you know, the study is very clear in saying this is their best estimate, yep. and it's done by sort of professionals in the field, but they don't have access to classified information.
Former US military people whose job was this kind of stuff.
Yeah. They're saying that the Gulf states alone fired 250 Patriot PAC-3 interceptors.
Whoa.
And 30 THAAD interceptors.
Now, remind me, how many Patriots have the Americans been making a year?
I don't know. I don't have that off the top of my head, but it's in the probably hundreds maximum.
Yeah, so if you're firing 250 in 36 hours as a Gulf state, you are denuding the global inventory. Right, and just on the numbers and lead time, so just to give an idea of numbers, so back in April last year, 9th of April, the Pentagon advised the Congress that Australia had ordered 200 AIM-120 missiles.
So AMRAAM, yep.
Well, 200 one variant, 200 of another variant, mm-hmm. $1.04 billion US dollars, and that was in April last year. Now, that means those missiles, best case,
we haven't got.
We're going to turn up in 2029. Mm-hmm. This shows the enormous gap in our Australian military capability.
Well, the scary thing is, from an Australian perspective, is so the US and the Gulf states fired 700 high-end interceptors to defend an area that's roughly, if you take the total area of the Gulf states, is a third of the size of Australia.
Well, because you're including Saudi Arabia, yep. the big guy.
Yeah. So 700 to defend that area. The bad news is we don't actually have those interceptors. We got some SM-2s on our three
air warfare destroyers,
one of which is in upgrade at the moment. But we have no high-end ground-based interceptors to defend the huge area of Australia. All we actually have in ground-based air defence is NASAMS, which is a good system. You know, it's been used to great effect in Ukraine, mm-hmm. much smaller than Australia.
Yep.
And it uses AMRAAM and AIM-9X. But it's not the kind of system designed.
Yeah.
It's not designed to defend Australia. It's designed to defend a deployed army task force.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
Now we are nude to air and missile attack.
We are rather nude. I mean, yeah. F-35s, the JSF, mm-hmm. combined with Wedgetail can potentially shoot down mm-hmm. missiles, cruise missiles yep. in flight. But all we've really got is NASAMS, which uses those AMRAAMs that apparently we're going to give away.
Yeah.
So we're giving away about the only thing we have, which is pretty much inappropriate for defending Australia anyway.
Yes. So now, but back to how well the war is going, there's some other good news. Not only is the war almost, is very complete and well ahead of schedule, according to President Trump, but President Trump had a call with Vladimir Putin, and it was a very constructive long call. And President Trump said it was a happy call. Putin said he wants to be constructive and helpful on the Iran war. And at the same time as Putin said that to President Trump, the Russians are providing targeting information to the Iranians to target U.S. forces.
So he is being helpful and constructive, yes, just not to the Americans.
To the Iranians. And in response to this helpful attitude that Vladimir is showing, President Trump has removed sanctions on Russian oil sales to India.
Mm-hmm.
So that will help Putin fund his continuing war of aggression against Ukraine.
Right. So not only is the price of oil going ballistic, Trump is now saying Putin can sell more of it.
He can take advantage of that price bump. That's right.
So Putin's getting much more cash to fund the war in Ukraine.
Yes.
Meanwhile, he's providing information to the Iranians to target U.S.
Americans, yes,
assets and U.S. partners.
Yes, including things like that really valuable THAAD radar that was damaged, which is, it's about $1 billion U.S., I think, for that radar.
And I think it was more than damaged.
Yeah, they're moving one from South Korea to replace it.
By the way, South Korea, South Korean air defense missiles are proven themselves in this conflict already, which is very interesting. So it just
not in Iranian hands, I hope.
No, in countering Iranian threats. Mm. So it goes to show that there are actually other providers out there beyond the traditional US primes. So,
well, I'd suspect that the French frigate and aircraft on the aircraft carrier that are equipped with French missiles are a viable alternative too. Yes.
Yes. So anyway, the ripple effect of the war, there's some good ripples heading Vladimir Putin's way.
Yes. Yeah. And interestingly, President Zelensky of Ukraine has responded to a US and Gulf state request, and he's providing counter-drone people and systems already. He's already sent a Ukrainian counter-drone team into the region.
And that's because President Zelensky and the Ukrainians actually learned the right lessons out of the Ukraine war.
And unlike that disastrous berating that Zelensky got from J.D. Vance when in the White House.
Oh, he had no cards?
It turns out he's got some very good cards that could save lives.
Mm.
Yeah. So that's an irony, isn't it, that Trump's so happy with his chat with Putin, but the guy that's actually helping him is Zelensky.
Is the guy with no cards.
Yeah.
Yeah. Boy, there's a lot of ironies here, Michael.
Another little snippet that says this war is not going quite as swimmingly as we would like it to be is the Israeli Defense Force has just issued evacuation orders for more communities in northern Israel because despite the IDF ground operation into Lebanon against Hezbollah, they can't stop Hezbollah launching attack drones into northern Israel.
Mm. It's interesting because Israel claimed that it had pretty much decapitated Hezbollah.
Well, I think it's like the complete obliteration of the Iranian nuclear program. Mm. You know, complete obliterations aren't what they used to be.
No, they seem to be temporary obliterations.
Yeah. Now, I think, so we are seeing a war that has mission creep, and there'll be a continued blurring of the defensive and the offensive despite best efforts of governments like the Albanese government to try and make a bright shining line between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And the effect on Australia's military capability is interesting. So any idea that we were building big stockpiles of advanced missiles that were coming from America, that's dead for years now.
I mean, I think what this really shows is sort of how limited, the limited number of options we actually have. I mean, yes, Wedgetail, okay, but you go, well, we can't send any ships because we've only got 3 air warfare destroyers and one's in upgrade. So we're down to, I think, 7 ANZACs at the moment, but ANZACs are really only armed with ESSM, so essentially a short-range air defence missiles.
The utility of the ANZAC frigate, I think, when it comes to oil tankers going through the Straits of Hormuz, is they're like a decoy duck. So we could send a decoy duck there, but I would not send it as a warship that's going to help protect things. Yes.
Get technical. Theoretically, ESSM on the ANZACs does have a crossing target capability. So theoretically, if ANZAC is here, oil tanker is nearby and a missile is heading towards the oil tanker, theoretically, it can take out the missile.
Yes.
But I would note that we never deployed ANZACs to the conflict with the Houthis.
Yes.
I think partly because the risk...
Their vulnerability.
You just get to the point where there's so many risks that it's probably just not worth the effort. So I think it really does show the limited options we actually have, which is rather depressing. So despite, you know, this record investment in defence capability, we don't seem to have a lot of options.
Yeah, all the hoopla about historic, massive decisions, groundbreaking, never before done, enormous change, boldest reform in Australia's history, breathtaking, mind-boggling, the cupboard is bare. But I think there'd be a chunk of people inside the Australian Defence Department and Defence Force and a bunch of people in government offices up in the Parliament who are actually quite delighted not to have much to send, because they certainly are in the partly willing part of this coalescence.
Look, and I don't have to say I'm not sort of itching to send.
I'm not all in on this either. We see an escalating conflict that's having massive ripple effects, not just in the region but around the globe. And it does not look like a good plan, and it is not all going swimmingly.
I mean, the upside is that I'm about to get very rich once I work out how to synthesize defense strategic documents into liquid fuel, and I'm on the cusp of that. I've been reading some Renaissance texts on alchemy,
yes.
And I think there's. The secret is buried in there. But we started to talk about the squintillions of dollars, the really big bags of money that's being spent on Australian capability. And there's been a few announcements recently. We might just review
There is a missile that's popping out of a shed in Australia now.
Yeah.
The GMLRS missile, which is one of my favourites.
GMLRS, yes. So it's a missile launched by the HIMARS missile launcher, which sprung to international fame during the war in Ukraine.
Which is still happening, yes. So I think there was a press release out of Defence on the 4th of March saying the first production of Australian-built GMLRS missiles, they're about a 70-kilometre land attack missile, and will pop out in mid-March.
Well, yeah, so apparently it only takes 11 days. So they, starting on the 4th of March, will be completed by mid-March. So
all this, it takes 4 years to make a missile. The bod's down in this shed in Adelaide. And making them in 11 days. That is miraculous.
Yes.
Well, I think there's two reasons for that, aren't there?
Well, I think one reason is we're not actually making them here.
No.
I think we might be assembling a lot of US components here. So,
you know, if you came across this missile in Woolworths or Coles, or you could be an Aldi shopper, it would be in a packet with some labelling standards applied, and the label would say, assembled GMLRS, assembled in Australia from 100% imported ingredients. You wouldn't be able to put that little Aussie gold kangaroo on it.
Probably not. Now, our listeners might recall that a year or so ago, the government announced that it was spending $500 million to build a big shed to make these missiles and to kind of upskill Australian businesses to provide components.
It was the MOAS, the mother of all sheds, until the submarine shed.
Until the submarine shed, which is the, I don't know, is it the daddy of all
sheds? It's the DOAS. We've got the MOAS being built.
Yes, but the MOAS isn't going to be finished until about 2029. So by 2029, we won't be doing this cottage industry assembling.
No.
We're meant to be doing 4,000 GMLRS a year, which I think would be quite remarkable to do that. That's an awful lot of missiles, but considering they cost about 250,000 Aussie, that's $1 billion worth of GMLRS a year
The GMLRS missile is it won't be in high demand in this war in Iran, because it's a short-range land attack missile, only useful if you're doing a large ground operation.
Are you saying we should put boots on the ground, Michael?
Well, otherwise we're not going to be able to use these missiles. I mean, what's the point of making them?
Well, just to go back to the
mission creep,
which is apparently not occurring, according to our strategic experts. But that is one of the things that Donald Trump has postulated.
Yes.
Is, well, maybe we might put some boots on the ground.
Well, he might say, who can come? Oh, you Aussies, you've got heaps of these short-range land missiles. You'd be perfect.
So apparently the Kurds, the Iranian Kurds living in exile in Iraq, were Donald Trump was going to unleash them. Then it turned out there was only a few thousand of them. And then he sort of postulated maybe some American boots on the ground, but that would be a use for the Gimlars.
It would.
All right, what else is happening?
The Peregrine, didn't you tell me? We have the first of these fantastic electronic warfare aircraft.
Yes, the MC-55A Peregrine. First one is in country, arrived in January. Now,
It's the season for migratory birds to turn up, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, peregrines live here all the time, though, Michael.
Not this one. It's just turned up.
There are peregrines in the Brindabellas here. Okay. But this one has just turned up. Now, which is good, very good. There's just a couple of issues about the Peregrine, however. It's meant to be flying 400 hours this year, and that's meant to cost us $128 million in sustainment. Unfortunately, last year, we spent $162 million on sustainment for zero flying hours. I'm not quite sure how you do that. But we managed to do it.
It's an expensive bird. Yep. Yes.
The other sort of interesting and expensive news about the Peregrine is on the US Defense Security Cooperation Agency website, so the organization that manages the foreign military sales.
You mean program. The place where we find out about Australian defense issues?
Correct. Yes. Apparently, in last year, the US approved a baseline 2 upgrade to the MC-55A Peregrine for $404 million.
Okay,
so before we've even gotten this thing into service, we're spending, and we spent $162 million
to maintain the aircraft to operate,
but it wasn't actually flying. Yep. We're now spending $404 million, so about $600 million Aussie, on an upgrade for something
we haven't got. We've got one
in service yet.
That is,
but I'm sure it'll be a great capability when it's actually in service. At
well,
some
once
point.
The upgrade's complete.
Another great Aussie news: the first Australian-made canine Huntsman, so the self-propelled howitzers built by Hanwha in the electorate of a politician. I'm just trying to think which politician.
Dickie Miles,
the Minister for Defence / Deputy Prime Minister in his electorate.
Actually, they both take credit. I've heard both Dickie Miles and Richard Miles take credit for this.
First Australian-made Huntsman has been delivered. This is only 7 years after Prime Minister Morrison said, as a bit of a an election sweetener, I think 3 elections ago now, said we were going to build self-propelled howitzers in Australia. So mere 7 years.
You know, these are the Bugatti Chiron of self-propelled howitzers, these Australian ones. The ones that are built in South Korea, they just pop off this automated production line. You know, it's like watching rabbits breed. You don't want those.
I've actually been to that factory, and they literally can produce multiple per day.
Yeah, whereas these ones, they are lovingly, artisanally hand-assembled by Vern. I'd like to give a call out to Vern and Cheryl. I think you do great work down there. And if you and your grandchildren can keep at that, we can keep that 7-year drumbeat happening.
Look, I'm sure they are very good self-propelled howitzers, you know, and I do think it's a capability we need. I do think that one of the lessons, and I could be learning the wrong lessons out of Ukraine, but I think one of the lessons out of Ukraine is you need shed loads of artillery, even the old-fashioned kind.
And it's good if it's mobile,
The only issue is like everything in the IIP, our Integrated Investment Program, by the time we actually get it, the world has moved on. Similar thing here. We're meant to be getting 2 regiments of these howitzers. We've now changed that plan and gone, well, we've ordered the 1st regiment. We'll stick with that. We'll get more HIMARS rocket launchers instead. So Hanwha's gone to all the effort of building a factory.
And they're producing a tiny orphan number.
They're doing roughly 50 vehicles.
Yeah, but they will be beautiful. I'm thinking of buying one because they would just appreciate. They're going to be a collector's item.
But there's great news on shipbuilding. So
is this the Henderson Precinct?
Yeah, so a couple of episodes again, we were talking about the world's biggest shed in Osborne in South Australia. The West Australians are going, what about us?
Yeah, they're not going to be left behind.
Show us some love. So we have an announcement.
A bit of Henderson FOMO happening here.
Yeah, so, but it's a bit hard to actually see the real announcement. It's one of those announceables that sort of sounds a bit like something we've heard before.
So I remember there was the $127 million of funded studies design and consultancy, which was going to take about 4 years.
I remember that great day. It was October 2024, and the government said, we are cracking on with Henderson. $127 million.
For studies.
On studies. And then last year, they announced, I think it was $15
billion. $12 billion.
$12 billion, yes.
But it was actually a $25 billion announcement. They just didn't know where the other money was going to come from. I think venture capital looks so hot right now.
Well, yeah. It was $12 billion as a down payment on the full $25 billion. Yep. So that was last year.
That was just before Albo's meeting with Trump. It was almost like meeting stocking fillers. I don't know.
So there was another Henderson announcement just a couple of days ago. You're thinking maybe we've learned what that $12 billion actually going to be spent on.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it was this announcement. We don't actually get the answer. What we've found out is the government has signed a contract with Bechtel, big engineering company, to do some planning.
Yeah, I think I heard what they're doing. It's a design services consultancy contract.
That sounds big.
For them to undertake master planning for the Henderson precinct.
Okay.
So
a year and a half ago, we said we were going to do some planning.
Yep.
Now, a year and a half later, we're saying we've signed a contract
to do some master
planning. To do the planning.
Yes. Okay. And master planning, if people don't know, is not. Here's a design for the Orca submarine maintenance facility, and here's a design for the new shipyard to build the heavy landing craft and the Mogami frigates. Master planning is like a big pro heart sketch of I've got this much area, that bit can go over there, no, that bit's going to go a bit to the right, there's a gap here, so here's the rough sketch of the layout.
Okay, now on the crawl, walk, runs spectrum,
yes,
so beloved of our guided weapons enterprise, where are we at Henderson now?
We're preparing to crawl.
We're preparing to crawl, yes. Okay, right. Yes. Because they wouldn't want to show up the Guio Enterprise.
Well, that'd be mission creep, Marcus.
Yeah, okay. So, Henderson, I have to say, and just on a serious note, everybody I talk to outside of defence and government on this issue goes, nothing is happening.
Yes. Well, I think this is a confirmation that nothing is still happening.
The proof of this is when the government recently announced that it had gotten into contract for the build of the landing craft medium and the landing craft heavy, and good, they are capabilities we need. Good.
They're meant to happen in the Henderson precinct.
Precinct. What we learned from that is we're actually going to start building the landing craft heavy, so 4,000-tonne ship, sort of in existing kind of space where there isn't really a shipyard. And once we've actually gotten around to building a shipyard, we'll move the program into the shipyard.
Yes. There is an
interesting approach.
There's an old-fashioned notion you need a shipyard to build ships.
Yeah, interesting approach. We'll build the ships before the shipyard. Final capability announcement. Minister Conroy has announced that he had a product of concern summit for the Collins. Now, for our listeners, probably aware of projects of concern. So those are acquisition projects that have gone seriously bad.
Yep.
Product of concern is for sustainment.
See, I love the way defence continues to innovate in groundbreaking ways. So they're producing multiple forwards for documents now, which is more feedstock for you.
Mm-hmm.
They've now not just got projects of concern summits, they've got products of concern summits. That innovation is mind-boggling.
Yeah. So Collins submarines, so the submarines we actually have now.
Yes.
The sustainment of them, apparently, to be a product of concern, would have serious issues.
Yes.
But Minister Conroy is on it because Collins was listed as a product of concern in December 2024 and has had four summits.
Well,
since then. So
I mean, you cannot ask for more. And
the meetings are coming
thicker and faster.
Thick and fast there.
Well, I mean, maybe he could dig out the coal review on the Collins, which was all about sustainment trouble.
I thought we'd cracked it.
Yeah, I thought we had too. So we had, and now it's cracked itself.
But now it's cracked again. But this is a bit of a worry because what we do know is that whatever happens with Virginia-class submarines and whatever happens with Snorkus, so the UK design, whatever happens there, we don't know what's going to happen there, but we do know that Collins is the submarine that we have now.
Yeah, the one you're with.
And even if the optimal pathway, the transition to a nuclear submarine capability, even if it is delivered on schedule and according to plan,
I think you're the only person outside government ministers and defence officials that can say the optimal pathway might be delivered as planned and not giggle.
I'm a serious person, Michael. Yeah.
So sorry, even if it
is delivered on plan, Collins needs to keep going, not just deep into the 2030s, so another decade and a bit, but probably even into the 2040s.
Yep.
So it's a bit of a worry when we're going, this thing needs to keep going for over 15 years, needs to go through an extensive life of type extension, so a massive upgrade and replacement of its major systems. But even the current basic sustainment of the platform today
maintaining the thing
is a product of concern.
Well, but isn't that cause for celebration, though, from a jobs point of view? Because each of those products of concern summits requires a whole lot of employment. You've got a whole lot of people producing a whole lot of paperwork, and there'll be roughly 20 of those products of concern summits between now and that time. So it's jobs, more jobs, feedstock, jobs.
More feedstock.
Yeah, and feedstock for the bunker here. Well, Marcus, thank you for that capability roundup, and thank you for helping me understand why, now that Australia is a part of this war, we should be watching for more mission creep. Thanks, Marcus.
Thank you, Michael.